Lesson 55, Melville's Bartleby and the Genesis of Character.
I'd like to talk to you about one of the strangest and most prophetic short stories in American literature, namely Melville's Bartleby. It's strange because it's strange to the narrator. That is to say, this guy is the most enigmatic figure in literature. The main focus of this lecture is going to be about this figure, Bartleby, and the genesis of character. He comes across as strange, as a riddle to the people in the story. But I use the word prophetic because most people who first read this story of Melville's are stunned to learn that this thing was written in the 1850s, that it's hard to believe it's not a 20th century story, that its issues of anonymity, its issues of the workplace, its issues of bureaucracy seem to be those already of a Kafka or of a 20th century writer. And when we put it in its place in mid-19th century, it seems even stranger. I'd like to characterize the great literature of the American 19th century as a literature of utterly larger-than-life, swollen figures. One thinks of Emerson's self-reliant man, an independent figure who liberates himself from all of the other voices of the world, or Thoreau's fiercely independent iconoclast who goes to Walden and who lives on his own and gets clear of the mesh of society. Or, which you've already seen in this course, Whitman's gargantuan Song of Myself, this figure who takes in everything. But think, too, of the prose of Hawthorne, of Hester Prynne, this very strong-willed woman in The Scarlet Letter, or perhaps the most grandiose figure of all, Melville's own titanic Captain Ahab from Moby Dick. These are all dynamos of sorts. These are sort of paragons of confidence and a kind of creatural certainty. And they speak volumes together about the great myth of the 19th century self, a time when the notion of self is a confident, exciting, almost territorializing, almost imperial notion. This is, I think, a tradition that begins really in full blast in 19th century American letters and literature. I hardly have to remind you that it's a tradition that is very much alive with us today, that we are the country that subscribes most passionately to the notion of full-bodied individualism. It is part of our political culture. I don't think it's wrong to say that it's part of our religious culture, that we believe in the rights and integrity and freedom of the individual, and we believe in that socioeconomically, we believe in that morally, religiously, etc. These are the articles of belief in the United States. All of those issues come into play, it seems to me, when you have a character like Bartleby, about what is an individual. Now, this figure is known to generations of readers as the kind of famous person who constantly said, "I would prefer not to." That's his constant refrain in this short story. He's the scrivener who comes into this law office and denies, refuses to work. But I want to talk further about how he's presented by Melville and what kind of questions are being raised here, and questions raised against the backdrop of these larger-than-life, full-blooded figures who give us clearly at least the appearance of a kind of unproblematic, unquestioned self. And after all, that's one of the oldest burdens of literature, is to give us life stories that we can believe. Presumably, any author who writes the story of someone wants us to take seriously that creature in the story. Now, we all know that the author starts with a piece of paper and a pencil and creates that person out of nothing. We know that. These aren't real people who are living in books. The great convention and the great fun and the great meaning of literature is that we take these people for real people. And when you read a book, you don't really question that. And if you do, you usually put the book down. You say, well, I can't believe in these characters. That's one of the most obvious and most listened to critiques of novels. The worst thing you can say about a novel in a review is that these characters were not credible. And there's a very deep convention here about the way in which we construct creatures in text and what we expect the readers to think and to feel. And the most important books, the most compelling books, are the ones where, in a sense, the reality of the character jumps out at us from the page, and that we assent to the behavior of this figure, we assent to the way this figure is rendered in the text. That's why a character who says very little in a story, and among the very few things he says is the constant refrain, "I would prefer not to," that's a kind of real crisis on your hands. And I want to show you the ways in which this figure, Bartleby, is presented as a blank, enigmatic, spectral, and unreal creation. And in doing that, I'll try to comment further about why this is, I think, a significant issue, the ghostliness of this person, the lack of information that we have about him. This story, as you may remember, is being told by the narrator, who is the lawyer, the barrister who runs this copyist office, and he's reflecting many years later about the strange encounter with this man Bartleby, who comes in, and this encounter is so strange that that's why we have the story. I mean, Bartleby is such an enigma, such a riddle, that it's still sort of goading this man. He's still trying to make sense of this odd person who came into his life. He says this, "While of other law copyists I might write the complete life, of Bartleby nothing of that sort can be done. I believe that no materials exist for a full and satisfactory biography of this man. It is an irreparable loss to literature. Bartleby was one of those beings of whom nothing is ascertainable except from the very original sources, and in his case, those are very small." Now, the story of this odd, strange figure who seems to be blank, who only says no, and who walks into a law office on Wall Street in mid-19th century New York, that's a story that has understandably engaged critics and readers for a long time. And it does so in predictable ways. If you have a character who seems to be a riddle, then the kind of response that gets triggered is, who is he really? Melville must be writing a kind of allegory here. He must be talking about somebody that we know about. And a lot of the criticism fills in the blank. It's as if this story were kind of literary charades and a well-known dignitary was presented in disguise in the figure of Bartleby. So people have said, well, Bartleby is the way Melville presents Thoreau. Or Bartleby is Melville's portrait of Hawthorne. Or Bartleby is the way Melville saw Emerson. Or most obviously, Bartleby is how Melville saw Melville. Now, I should say to you that when Melville wrote this story, his career was in serious decline. The career of Melville is itself a fascinating chapter in American literature. We, in hindsight, regard Melville as the giant of 19th century American literature. He's the man who wrote what some people think of as the great American novel, Moby Dick. However, before he wrote Moby Dick, he was a very popular author. He had been on the seas, he had been shipwrecked, and he wrote his first novel. It's called Typee, and it's about a shipwreck. And it was one of these exotic South Seas stories, and it talked about natives and cannibals. And it was a thinly veiled version of his own experiences, and it was a bestseller. And it established Melville overnight as a major author. And then he wrote slightly more metaphysical stories about the high seas and about being a man of the sea. And they too sold. However, when he wrote Moby Dick in 1850, we come to the end of his popularity. And Moby Dick is a very fascinating text in order to get a picture of Bartleby. Moby Dick is written in 1850, and Moby Dick is a story that on the one hand is still another sea story. And if you've read it, you know that it has more information about whaling and about boats than you'd ever want to know. It's filled with ballast and dictionary-type information. On the other hand, it also has more metaphysics, more fantasy, more rich Shakespearean language than you can also deal with. And it's as if Melville just pulls out all the stops in that novel. We now recognize this novel as one of the great stories about American culture, and also about the nature of evil and the nature of goodness and the nature of knowledge. But you can believe me, it was not seen that way in 1850. People thought Melville had gone off his rocker, that this man had simply lost touch with reality, and it was the end of a career. He then followed it with another novel that was even more of a lulu called Pierre that no one wanted to read. And from then on out, Melville becomes a ghost himself in American literature. People are not tending to Melville. And he broods on this and lives a long time. Writes finally at the end of his life, Billy Budd in the 1880s, which achieved a certain kind of recognition and is now seen as one of his great stories. However, Bartleby comes in the post-Moby Dick years too. It's in the later 1850s. And I think it's important, therefore, if you see this strange figure about whom nothing can be known, this figure who we will learn at the end of the story probably worked in a dead letter office, then we cannot help but think that this might be a portrait of Melville as an alienated writer. Melville is a person who has no public. This odd story of a man who walks into a law office, is hired to be a copyist, and immediately stops working and refuses to do anything that is asked of him, also absolutely begs for us to interpret it as some kind of a social allegory. What produces this? What makes a man walk in and refuse to say anything about himself or refuse to do the job that he has? Lots of explanations have been given. People have said, well, maybe he's a portrait of the artist. Not Melville, but just the artist in general. That's the allegory that Melville is telling. Others have said, maybe this is a portrait of conscience. This is what virtue and integrity mean. He refuses to compromise. All right, that's possible. Others have said, maybe this is Christ. Maybe this is what Jesus would look like if he returned to life and entered a law office in New York. These are all possible readings. The fact is, there are no answers. That's what the inscrutability of this figure keeps telling us. We can guess all we want. There's no way really to know. There's no obvious key here, and that's Melville plays on that. I mean, Melville is a very arch kind of writer. He likes to sort of give you hints about what he's doing. For example, early in the story, we read this. Here it must be said that according to the custom of most legal gentlemen occupying chambers in densely populated law buildings, there were several keys to my door. One was kept by a woman residing in the attic, which person weekly scrubbed and daily swept and dusted my apartments. Another was kept by Turkey, one of the people who works for him, for convenience sake. The third I sometimes carried in my own pocket. The fourth I knew not who had. That's like Melville trying to tip his hat and say, look, there are lots of keys to this story, lots of ways to understand this story. I'm not even sure who has the real key. And that has proven also to be the case. People haven't been able to figure out the story. Now, I said, what makes a man refuse to do the work that he's supposed to do? And we could say, well, maybe this is a critique. This isn't a person showing up. In other words, Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Melville. Maybe this is a critique. It's not even Jesus or the artist. Maybe this is instead Melville's way of writing about his own cultural moment. Maybe this is what Melville thinks of Wall Street. Maybe this is what Melville thinks of capitalism. Maybe this is what Melville thinks of what it means to live in a city like New York. All of those are possibilities. All of those are part of the other larger question is, what must have produced this figure? What would account for this man behaving the way he does? What makes a blank person, and now I'm shifting, not just a person who refuses to work, but a person who refuses to be known, a person who presents himself as a blank sort of slate. What would produce that? What would make someone anonymous? Now, I want you to think about that as I show you some of the ways in which the story proceeds. Here's one of the first instances where the lawyer narrator discovers what a strange bird this new employee is. Their office is described in wonderful ways. It's totally, totally inhuman. Whenever the lawyer has another text for his copyist to copy down, he doesn't say anything to him. He doesn't even look at him. He just puts his hand out like that and expects Bartleby or one of his other clerks to simply pick it up, sit down, and go to work. So that's what he's doing. In this very attitude that I sit when I call to him, rapidly stating what it was this time he tells him to do, namely to examine a small paper with me, imagine to my surprise, nay, my consternation, when without moving from his privacy, because Bartleby is in this little bitty cubicle, with they're all walls between these people, Bartleby, in a singularly mild, firm voice, replied, "I would prefer not to." I sat a while in perfect silence, rallying my stunned faculties. Immediately it occurred to me that my ears had deceived me, or Bartleby had entirely misunderstood my meaning. I repeated my request in the clearest tone I could assume, but in quite as clear a one came the previous reply, "I would prefer not to." "Prefer not to?" echoed I, rising in high excitement and crossing the room with a stride. "What do you mean? Are you moonstruck? I want you to help me compare this sheet here. Take it," and I thrust it to him. "I would prefer not to," said he. Now, here's the way he's described. I looked at him steadfastly. His face was leanly composed, his gray eye dimly calm. Not a wrinkle of agitation rippled him. Had there been the least uneasiness, anger, impatience, or impertinence in his manner, in other words, had there been anything ordinarily human about him, doubtless I should have violently dismissed him from the premises. But as it was, I should have as soon thought of turning my pale plaster of Paris bust of Cicero out of doors. Now, that's an unusual description of this guy. Do you notice that everything that is said about him is what he is not? Had there been uneasiness, anger, impatience, or impertinence, I'd have chucked him right out. That's not what there was. Had there been anything ordinarily human, I would have, there's none of that either. How is he described? Not a wrinkle of agitation rippled him. Do you hear what an exercise in negatives that is? Not a wrinkle, first of all, it's a wonderful sea metaphor, agitation rippling a face, but don't think it happened because it didn't. Not a wrinkle of agitation rippled him. What I'm trying to get at is that this story is a story about erasure. It's a story about suggesting things and trying to do a portrait of someone where everything is what this person is not. We can't get hold of what he actually might be, what he is. Now, there is a denial of all information. This is one of the nicer exchanges between the lawyer and his employee. "Bartleby," said I, gently calling to him behind the screen. No reply. "Bartleby," said I, in a still gentler tone, "come here. I'm not going to ask you to do anything you would prefer not to. I simply wish to speak to you." Upon this, he noiselessly slid into view. He always appears like a ghost. Noiselessly slid into view. "Will you tell me, Bartleby, where you were born?" "I would prefer not to." "Will you tell me anything about yourself?" "I would prefer not to." "But what reasonable objection can you have to speak to me? I feel friendly towards you." He did not look at me while I spoke, but kept his glance fixed upon my bust of Cicero, which as I then sat was directly behind me, some 6 inches above my head. "What is your answer, Bartleby?" said I, after waiting a considerable time for a reply, during which his countenance remained immovable, only there was the faintest conceivable tremor of the white, attenuated mouth. "At present, I prefer to give no answer," he said, and retired into his hermitage. Now, where were you born? Will you tell me anything about yourself? That is the stock and trade of producing characters. That's what we learn in books about people, as we do in life. This contract is being broken here. This guy ducks out of every effort to tell you who he is. He's completely blank. There is no way of getting to the bottom here. And what I want to say here is that he is presented to us as an empty character. He is, in fact, presented to us as a kind of leprous character because he makes everything around him empty as well. Here's some of the terms that are used to describe him. Motionless young man, you've already seen. He's called mildly cadaverous. He appears as an apparition, like a very ghost. He slides into view. He slides aside. That there is simply nothing to get your hands on here. And what I want to suggest is that he represents, in that sense, the very construct of character itself. Character as a construct, character as the artisanal business of the writer. I've got a book to write. I've got a pen here. I've got ideas. I'll construct someone whom I'm going to call Bartleby, whom I'm going to call Pip, whom I'm going to call Quentin Compson, whom I'm going to call Hamlet. Writers have been doing this forever. But usually, as I say, they clothe those words with something that makes us believe in the materiality and in the reality of those figures. That's not the case here. Over and over, this figure is presented to us as just a construct, as just language. And therefore, it's not uninteresting that this figure, his job is to be a copyist, to just copy other documents. And we read, for example, that he, as Melville writes, he gorges on documents, as if long famishing for something to copy, because originally when he comes in, he does copy. That's before he stops. He seemed to gorge himself on my documents. And it leads to the possibility that he is a paper creature, eating paper, that he is simply filling himself up with other documents. And this leads to the other kinds of behavioral tricks in this story, that there are ways in which this character expresses himself, which we begin to realize that these words don't mean only what we think. The narrator, trying to interest Bartleby and to have him tell him more about himself. He says, he's trying to give him different possible occupations. Would you like to re-engage in copying for someone? No, I would prefer not to make any change. Would you like a clerkship in a dry goods store? There is too much confinement about that. No, I would not like a clerkship, but I am not particular. Too much confinement, I cried. Why, you keep yourself confined all the time. I would prefer not to take a clerkship, he rejoined. How about a bartender's business? That's marvelous to imagine Bartleby the bartender. How would a bartender's business suit you? There's no trying of the eyesight in that. I would not like it at all, though, as I said before, I am not particular. His unwanted wordiness inspirited me. I returned to the charge. Well, then, would you like to travel through the country collecting bills for the merchants? That would improve your health. No, I would prefer to be doing something else. How about going as a companion to Europe to entertain some gentleman with your conversation? How would that suit you? Not at all. It does not strike me that there is anything definite about that. I like to be stationary, but I am not particular. I like to be stationary, but I am not particular. Well, what does the word particular mean? Particular literally does mean unique, single, specific. I am not stationary. I like to be stationary. He is stationary. With an E, not an A. I mean, he's just a letter. He's just something to write on. He's just that the whole sort of construct, the whole business of literature is becoming somehow flaunted in front of our eyes here. He gorges on documents. And that's a way of saying that the world becomes documents. It becomes linguified. It becomes language. But it's also a way of saying that language becomes a thing in this text. Now, what is he doing? As I said, he's a copyist. Copyist, and it's really dull, soulless work. They hand documents out, and all four of the clerks are supposed to sit around a table and each copy them. This is the days before the Xerox machines. He is a Xerox machine. Bartleby is the 19th century Xerox machine, and he refuses to continue to do it. This is a story which suggests that all we do is copy. That's what his job is. They bring him into this office, and they say, will you please copy these documents? At first he does it. He gorges himself on documents. After a while, he refuses to. Now, I'm doing exactly what I said this story makes us do. It won't tell us why things are happening. And so we step into the breach and try to figure out why they're happening. And therefore, what my suggestion is that this is a very, very rich meditation, despite the apparent thinness of its materials, about originals and about copies. You remember how I began this? I quoted the narrator who said, about Bartleby, there is no information to be had. There are no original documents. Now, what does this mean, that there are no original documents? And what does it mean to have copies? The story closes with an effort to try to understand Bartleby, and it closes with the discovery made later, after Bartleby is dead, by the narrator lawyer, that Bartleby at some point had worked in a dead letter office. And there, too, I think we have this notion that this is Melville reflecting on his own career. Everything he has written is dead letters. The words haven't gotten anywhere. Nothing has arrived. But it is also the notion, as well, that all writers do is copy. Now, I want you to think about that one. all writers do is copy. Bartleby is a scribe. Bartleby the Scrivener is one of the titles of the story. It's now just called Bartleby. His job is to copy documents. And people have said, well, that's just because he's a scribe. Melville doesn't copy. Melville is a writer. Melville writes things that are original. Now, I know some of you are not particularly fond of deconstruction. On the other hand, one of the arguments that has been made there is that everybody is a copyist. Every time we speak, we plagiarize. We can't be original. Everything that I'm saying here is made up of things that either I have heard or read, or that without even knowing it, other people have in some sense given to me. Just as the language that we use that comes out of our mouth is not something that we invented. It has its prior form. The great guru of deconstruction, Derrida, uses the expression always, already. That every time you try to make a gesture or an utterance, it is already preformed. You can't help that. We spend our lives trying to shape the preformed, the always, already, into our own expression. It's not an easy thing to do. Derrida would say it's not a possible thing to do. According to that line of reasoning, you remember I talked to you about intertextuality, that literature is about literature, that echoes of earlier texts find their way into later texts. It's a way of saying, therefore, that the clerk is a copyist, and so is the writer, and so is everybody else. We are all copyists. We are all further and further from the reality of the things themselves. I would add this to that. He is a 19th century Xerox machine. And I think that it's not an accident that much of the busy work of today's culture consists of Xerox machines. That we live in a paper world. Everybody who sees it who works in offices, and the amount of paper that has increased over the last several decades is astounding. More and more paper, less and less substance. We live at further and further distance from the reality of things. We just have documents that we process. We push papers. I've met people, and I've asked them, what do you do for a living? They say, I push papers. And that's what many executives and businesses, in fact, do. That's what Bartleby is asked to do, is to push papers, to sit there and just push documents. And I think that Melville's story is, in some really insistent way, not just a meditation about that, but a calling into question of that, whether what kind of a life that could be. I say calling into question because that, again, is why we have the story. The narrator has not been able to get past this empty, riddling figure who refuses to work. He's still chewing on it. The blankness of Bartleby is unbearable. The blankness of Bartleby. Melville is the most famous writer in American literature about blankness. Now, blankness is a funny thing. Blankness, as I've said, is an invitation for us to make sense of things. In Melville's most famous book, Moby Dick, the most famous chapter is called The Whiteness of the Whale. And what Melville says in that chapter is that what is most terrifying about this whale, Moby Dick, is the possibility that it means nothing. That the story is about a madman, Ahab, who is convinced that that whale represents evil because it is responsible for the loss of one of his legs. And he is going to destroy evil by going through the pasteboard mask, as he says, in order to get hold of this whale and kill it. But the book doesn't necessarily side with Ahab. And I shall close this lecture by reading you a passage about what blankness is, about the whiteness of the whale as the absence of any meanings. We're very close now to a world of the absurd where nothing has any form to it. Is it that by its indefiniteness it shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe, and thus stabs us from behind with the thought of annihilation when beholding the white depths of the Milky Way? Or is it that, as in essence, whiteness is not so much a color as the visible absence of color, and at the same time the concrete of all colors? Is it for these reasons that there is such a dumb blankness in a wide landscape of snow, a colorless all color of atheism from which we shrink? And when we consider that other theory of the natural philosophers, that all other earthly hues, every stately or lovely emblazoning, the sweet tinges of sunset skies and woods, yea, and the gilded velvets of butterflies, the butterfly cheeks of young girls, all of the colors that we think embroider and make the world visible and meaningful to us, all of the colors that have been so prominent in the poems that we've looked at, what Melville says, all of these are but subtle deceits, that whiteness precedes everything. They're subtle deceits, not actually inherent in substances, but only laid on from without, so that all deified nature absolutely paints like a harlot, that nature is ultimately blank, and it just sticks on the colors, puts on mascara, mask, and masquerade, ultimately, whose allurements cover nothing but the charnel house within. There's nothing but rot within. Well, we begin to see here in Melville a kind of fascination with blankness as being the ultimate reality of the world, and meaning, pattern, fullness, color, cogency, all of that as just a series of con games, of tricks by which we try to persuade ourselves that life makes sense. Blankness is there first. It is the base of reality. In this story, which I'm going to continue to talk about in the next lecture, Bartleby represents that threat. It's the capsizing of meaning. It's the possibility that there is no pattern, that there is no character at all. Thank you.